WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, critic at large for Entertainment Weekly, sitting in for Terry Gross. Last week, the judge in the Microsoft antitrust case ruled that Microsoft had bullied rivals and squelched competition. One of the most well-known companies to lose its competitive edge to Microsoft was Netscape, which marketed the first internet browser. In spite of Microsoft's purported monopoly, the founder of Netscape, Jim Clark, has managed to become a multi-billionaire. Clark has started several companies in addition to Netscape, such as Silicon Graphics, Healthion, and MyCFO. He's the subject of a just-published book called The New Thing, A Silicon Valley Story. It's written by Michael Lewis, whose first book was the best-selling Wall Street expose, Liar's Poker. For The New Thing, Lewis was granted extensive access to Jim Clark, from sitting in on multi-million dollar business deals to sailing with Clark on his massive computer-operated yacht. I began by asking Lewis what it was about Jim Clark, besides his wealth, that intrigued him.
Well, it was clear to me that what was unique about Silicon Valley was the way it foisted new technology upon the rest of us, and that it's really good at starting new things. And there was this character in the Valley, it took me 6 or 8 months to find him, but named Jim Clark, who was clearly the king of the starters. I mean, he was legendary for not having started just one new thing, but several new things. And the really interesting thing about him was that he couldn't stop, that when I met him, he just created his third, multi-billion dollar company, first Silicon Graphics, then Netscape, which of course triggered the whole internet boom, and then a company called Healthion, which was going to turn the U.S. healthcare industry on its head. And when I met him, he said he was kind of saying how it would be nice if he could retire and so on and so forth, and having done three of these things. And then he said, but it sure would be great to create a fourth. And it was the combination of having this character who was clearly had a kind of genius for inventing the future, and having a person who was about to go do it again and who would let me into his life and watch him that attracted me to him.
And what do you mean by the new thing?
Well, the new thing is the expression I use for an idea or a technology that's sort of poised on the brink of popular acceptance, and all it needs is a little shove from somebody to get going. And, the internet was that way in 1995 when Clark, created Netscape. It's that thing that all it requires is muscle from the right guy to get going. And the Valley, specializes in finding the new thing, sort of inventing the future. They have an expression in the Valley that they say that the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And there are these people out there, extraordinarily, who devote their lives to doing just that.
You say early on in the book that the internet was a Trojan horse in which techno-geeks entered all sorts of markets previously inhospitable to techno-geeks. Would you characterize Clark as one of those techno-geeks?
Yes, the quintessential one. I mean, he doesn't look like one exactly. He's sort of big and handsome, and it's surprising when you meet him that he is. But he's a technical man, he's a man with his PhD in computer science who spent the better part of his early career as a university professor of computer science, and then kind of discovered business at age, 38. And since then, watching this fantastic will wedded to technological aptitude, groping its way into more and more sectors of American life. I mean, this third company he created, Healthion, it came from a visit to the doctor's office. He went to the doctor's office and, of course, had to fill in all the forms that we have to fill in when we go to the doctor's office, and decided this was nonsense. All the bureaucracy in the healthcare industry could be eliminated with the internet. That he was going to create this company that would wire everybody together so that when you went into the doctor's office, the doctor would just hit a button to get your medical records and another button to find out what you were insured for and another button to send the bill to the insurance company, and you'd never be bothered by any of it. And it would all be much more efficient. He figured that, with his company, he could eliminate $300 or $400 billion in waste and, maybe keep $100 billion for himself. But in the process, you know, what he did is create a company filled with engineers writing software that was plopped down into the middle of the healthcare industry.
Mm-hmm. But give us a bit more of Jim Clark's background, because I found it really fascinating that hearing what he did and didn't do before he became so rich and influential makes that wealth and influence all the more impressive. I mean, you have this example in your book about him taking a multiple choice test, and he had never even seen one before.
His story teaches you the meaning of poverty, that poverty is not just being poor, it's also not even having the opportunity to discover what you're good at. He grew up poorer than poor in Plainview, Texas, and he was thrown out of the local high school at age 16. The family he grew up in was a mess. His mother was wonderful, but his father would beat her regularly, and he had a drinking problem. Clark sort of ejected out of Plainview unpromisingly and into the Navy at age 17. And the Navy tried to get him his high school equivalency, and they gave him this multiple choice test. He'd never seen one before. And he thought, as he read the test, he thought that, you know, some more than one of the answers was right in each case. And so he circled a whole bunch of answers. And the Navy thought he was trying to cheat the computer that graded the test. So they didn't even give him his high school equivalency. They shipped him out to sea to perform menial chores on a ship for a year. When he came back, he ended up in a math class. They gave him another shot. And he scored, they gave him a test, and he scored the highest in the class on the test. And even he didn't believe it. He didn't think he had any special aptitude. They gave him another test, and he scored the highest again. And in 6 weeks, he was teaching the class. And the naval instructor said, look, we haven't seen anybody with your kind of natural talent come through here in a long, long time. You've got to get on with your education. And in 7 years, he had not only his high school diploma, but his college degree, a master's in physics, and a PhD in computer science. And he was sort of mistakenly, as a result, channeled into the university. You know, he was a bad university professor for a lot of years, bouncing around, losing jobs. And at age 38, he's at Stanford and deeply unhappy, teaching computer science, when he had what he describes as kind of a transforming event in his life. He was so depressed. He'd run through a couple of marriages and a lot of jobs and didn't seem to be going anywhere with his life. It was one of those California moments. He decided he was just going to reinvent himself. And something actually happened to him. And I don't know, he can't quite explain it. But all of a sudden, he became kind of a leader in the Stanford department. And he turned this into a business opportunity. He had been working on a computer chip, which he called the Geometry Engine, which was going to make three-dimensional graphics possible and commercially possible. And with this chip, he created a company called Silicon Graphics, which, of course, is a very prominent company in Silicon Valley now. And his students followed him into the business. And that's where he got his start in business.
But between the invention of Silicon Graphics and Netscape, he had a kind of a stumble in this interactive television idea that he had.
That's a very interesting story.
Yeah.
Because it shows you the power. This is the prehistory of the internet boom. In the early 1990s, Clark decided that what Silicon Graphics really needed to do to preserve its business, because its business was being rapidly eroded by Microsoft, that it needed to create a telecomputer. He kept talking about the telecomputer. And the idea was that you were going to interact with your television set, because there'd be a computer chip in it. And you do all these different things through your television set, including email and e-commerce. Well, basically all the things we've come to do on the internet. And the people at Silicon Graphics didn't want to bother with this thing. They thought it was a distraction. So Clark, who was his title was chairman of the company, started talking to journalists. He discovered that journalists would believe anything and print it. And so he created a firestorm of publicity about the telecomputer. And sooner or later, he got hooked up through all this publicity with Time Warner, who was kind of thinking some of the same thoughts. And sure enough, Time Warner contracted Silicon Graphics to build a telecomputer in Orlando, Florida. They wired 4,000 homes with this thing to test it. Once this happened, it triggered a wave of capital and human expenditure in the high technology companies on telecomputers. Every big company was building its telecomputer at one point. Microsoft, AT&T, Oracle, I mean, you name it. The big high-tech companies all thought the telecomputer was going to be the next thing. This is all in a funny way, sort of Jim Clark's doing. Well, in the middle of building the telecomputer, it became clear that it just wasn't viable, that building, that the thing, the box was going to cost $20,000, $25,000, and nobody was going to pay this for a telecomputer. And Clark had become so disgruntled with his role inside of Silicon Graphics, he sort of sneaked out the place. And he bumped into a young man named Mark Andreessen, who had written the Mosaic program, which became the Netscape browser. And Mark Andreessen had abandoned any idea of making a business of this thing. But when Clark saw it, he realized that all these big dreams he'd had for the telecomputer, that it was they could be grafted onto the internet. It was a case of chance favoring the prepared mind. And so he created Netscape.
And this is, I love the way you have this phrase in the book, the telecomputer, which, you know, was even felt by Bill Gates to be a threat. You describe this transition as one of the great unintended head fakes in the history of technology.
It set all these people racing off in one direction, and Clark snuck out the door and went off in another direction, and then they all came racing back following him. You know, overnight, Microsoft's 1,000, they had 1,000 employees building interactive television. That department became the Internet Browser Department. He didn't mean to do it, but he was a great promoter of ideas. That is his role now in our world. And he promoted this idea, and it turned out to be wrong, but he managed to sell it to an awful lot of people.
I'm talking to Michael Lewis, the author of The New Thing, A Silicon Valley Story. Netscape, explain to us what that is, what an internet browser is. It was launched in 1994, and what did it enable people to do through their computers?
Well, it enabled them to travel around the internet and visit, you know, websites, and it made, this was something that people were already doing. It just made it easier to do, and it was a better means of transportation. Think of it that way, and it was overnight a sensation. You know, that they posted their software up on the internet and let people download it for free. And it was all over the place, almost instantly. So what it caused? I mean, it was the popularization of the internet, that people got a hold of their browsers and they started moving around the internet. And now it's just assumed that when you buy your computer, you know, it comes with one browser or another, usually Microsoft's browser now. But Netscape was what popularized this technology.
And by no coincidence at all, it also helped make Clark a billionaire.
Well, in the most extraordinary ways, too, because this company that he created, only 18 months after he created it, it had no profits, big losses is all it had, and no real clear plan for making profits. And yet they went to the stock market and said, we're going to sell shares in this thing. And the stock market did the most extraordinary thing. It said, fantastic, we'll buy, and drove the price of the stock up to just, you know, fantastic heights, making Clark, who owned the most shares, a billionaire.
Now, this is what I don't understand. As I read, I was thinking, because you write, no longer did you need to show profits. You needed to show rapid growth. Having a past actually counted against a company, for a past was a record, and a record was a sign of a company's limitations. To me, this seems like antithetical to every business concept. Am I missing something? No,
you're not missing anything. I mean, Warren Buffett himself says he doesn't understand what's going on, that old-fashioned investors can't fathom what's happened because, you know, historically in the markets assumed that your future profits bore some close relationship to your past profits. They extrapolated your future from your past. What the markets were saying all of a sudden in 1995 was that, we think that the future is going to be so different from the present that the past can't matter. So what we will buy is not a track record. We will buy a really persuasive story about your role in the future. And this is a huge psychological shift in the stock markets. I mean, a really big change. And all this stuff that's going on now with internet stocks, you know, it's a direct result of what Netscape started. It's now become the done thing to invest based on essentially a story or a concept rather than, hard financial data.
I'm talking to Michael Lewis, the author of The New Thing, A Silicon Valley Story. Let's take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Lewis. His new book is about Silicon Valley multi-billionaire Jim Clark, the founder of Netscape. Isn't there a sense in which this new world of internet startups and public offerings is a kind, it's kind of insane. It's one of those kind of self-perpetuating fantasies. It's almost like a pyramid scheme that keeps yielding real money for investors. Does it ever strike you that way? It's like a soap bubble that's being kept from bursting by some miracle?
It does feel a bit that way sometimes. And even, you know, never mind what I think, you know, people like Clark think that it's overdone. And that tells you something when the people on the inside wonder when it's all going to end.
Yeah.
But having said that, look, something very real is happening. I mean, the society is undergoing great technological change. The internet is a big, big deal. So something real is coming out of it. The question is, you know, how many of these companies that go public every week are going to survive and actually benefit the investors who put their money into them. Mm-hmm. And Lord only knows about that. You know, I've come to think of it a bit like one vast social conspiracy to channel capital to places where it might be of use. It's a bit like, I don't know, like the space program. You know, the space program, the government spent all kinds of money getting man into space. And as a result of that expenditure, there were all these wonderful inventions that were actually market-worthy came out of them. Mm-hmm. That throwing all the money at the technology actually produced all sorts of things, fruits. In a funny way, that kind of thing is going on now in Silicon Valley. That huge sums of money are being thrown at very smart people with really interesting ideas about how to change the world. And a lot of very positive change will come out of it, in the sense that a lot of, you know, wealth creation will come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a lot of turmoil will come out of it. But I wouldn't like to be in the business of choosing which companies will survive and which won't, because I think it's very hard to say, and a lot of them won't.
Mm-hmm. Can the business world take more than one Jim Clark? By which I mean, you know, if there were hundreds of Jim Clark-style entrepreneurs trying to operate the way he does, wouldn't they cause like a succession of disasters? It seems to me that, you know?
Well, there actually are hundreds of Jim Clark style entrepreneurs.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he just happens to be, I think, the most extraordinary case, but he is a type, you know, he's not a one-off, that there are lots of people who take this approach to the marketplace. They're pathological creators of things, that they start things and they move on. Silicon Valley happens to have more of these people than any other place on the planet, but these people exist in lots of Jim Clarks. He's just the most extraordinary.
And even though the book's done and out there, are you still following his career? I see that he's launching something called Shutterfly.com.
It's riveting. I watch him. You know, if you want to know where the world's going, you watch him.
Right.
Shutterfly is not the new thing. The new thing is this company he's created called MyCFO,
mm-hmm.
which has got, I mean, it's a new kind of financial institution he's created, which it's very vague and amorphous, but the best way to describe it is as a union of rich people, I think. But it's managed to get, Now the heads of Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs are trying to buy a piece of it because they see that, you know, if you gather all the assets up together in one pile, those assets will have a great power, and that's what he's trying to do. I follow rather closely what he's up to.
So my CFO is like a way of kind of managing the wealth of the ultra rich.
Yes,
but to what purpose?
He calls them the wealthy masses.
Uh-huh.
The idea, the way he's starting it, is by appealing to the rich people's desire to avoid paying taxes, and so it starts as a kind of tax consultancy business, and it tells you something about what's changed in American life, that partners at big eight accounting firms are racing out the door to join this enterprise and taking their customers with them, because working at the big eight accounting firm, they might make a nice high salary, but they'll never get rich. Whereas working for Jim Clark, they'll get a piece of the company and they might get rich. And so his idea is, first you get all the, you know, you get all the accountants that advise the rich into one place. Their clients come with them. And what begins as a tax advisory service can morph into all sorts of things. That if you've got, you know, as customers, people who control a few $1 trillion in assets, and you say to them, look, give us the right to negotiate on your behalf with Wall Street investment banks or commercial banks for various services, that money could have all kinds of leverage in the marketplace. If it sounds vague, it's because it is vague. But what's so, to me, so interesting about it is the force behind this thing, that the board of directors reads like a who's who of Silicon Valley. The head of Cisco, John Chambers, is on the board and owns a little piece of the company and is a customer of the company. Jim Barksdale, Tom Jermalak, who's the head of At Home, John Doerr, who's sort of the prominent venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, that you can already see these people who are, you know, some of the richest people in the country and the sort of trend-setting rich people in the country creating something new. And I don't think even they are quite sure what it's going to be. But and other than Clark's sort of original kind of vision that if you gathered all this money into one pile, it sure would be powerful.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Lewis is the author of The New New Thing. I'm Ken Tucker, and this is Fresh Air.